Welcome to our Blue Papers podcast edition. Blue Papers are our version of white papers here at Foreign Print. They cover a wide range of business topics, all with an aim to help your organization succeed. This is episode number 119, Collaboration. This episode is presented by Foreign Print Incorporated, customer service representative Jennifer Kohler.
Collaboration, a hot mess of growth and innovation. Renowned conductor Charles Hazelwood stands alone on stage. Normally, you'd find him surrounded by dozens of musicians, but not today, which seems odd because he's giving a TED Talk on collaboration, specifically on the role of trust and mutual respect in a successful collaborative effort. I am a conductor, and I'm here today to talk to you about trust. My job depends on it. There has to be, between me and the orchestra, an unshakable bond of trust, born out of mutual respect through which we can spin a musical narrative that we all believe in, he says. Then he slowly raises his hands. With subtle and silent skill, he summons the strains of solitary violin from the back of the auditorium. Then another. And another. Soon, the hall is filled with a beautiful soaring melody that swims around the audience as the members of the Scottish ensemble make their way to the stage, one by one. By the time Hazelwood silently stops the crescendo with the closing of his fist, he has demonstrated the point. Collaboration can deliver amazing results. But here's the thing. Real collaboration is also dangerous. To many, collaboration is an overwhelmingly positive word. It brings to mind utopian conditions where everyone gets along and works in harmony to make things happen faster and more efficiently. It's portrayed like working in an office staffed entirely by Care Bears. But that's just not reality. Real collaboration is about stepping outside of the established roles and traditional institutional structures to focus on results. Real collaboration is messy, and it involves a lot of collisions. Roles overlap, information gets disseminated with little gatekeeping, and authority has a tendency to get usurped by the group as a whole. For many organizations, it pushes them too far out of their comfort zones because it forces them to deal with the conflict that's a natural byproduct of effective collaboration. Hazelwood describes it in this way. I, as the conductor, have to come to the rehearsal with a cast iron sense of the outer architecture of that music, within which there is then immense personal freedom for the members of the orchestra to shine. So in order for all this to work, obviously I have got to be in a position of trust. I have to trust the orchestra, and even more crucially, I have to trust myself. Effective collaboration at an enterprise level is no different than what Hazelwood is describing. For collaboration to take hold and bear fruit within an organization, there needs to be a firm foundation of trust that gives employees the confidence to exercise their personal creativity within an outer architecture that outlines the organization's strategic plan. To put a finer point on it, effective collaboration requires a foundation built from a careful mix of three essential ingredients: trust, embracing conflict, and providing an environment that encourages employees to collide and share ideas. Taking the time to establish all three of those in your organization will greatly boost the success of your collaborative efforts in solving complex problems, boosting innovation, and delivering improved business results. So when you say dangerous, you don't really mean dangerous, do you? Yes, but not life-threatening. This is really about understanding scope and the cultural impact of embracing collaboration. In order to pull this off, you're going to ask people to change the way they behave, which is not always easy. Collaboration is much more than simply purchasing technology. It's about helping your employees think differently about how they work, make decisions, and communicate. That's why it's dangerous. Because in order to make the kinds of changes necessary to build trust, embrace conflict, and alter the work environment, you inevitably start to cross the line into organizational culture and personal work style. That's also why so many organizations fail to make real collaboration stick. They don't realize the scope of the change they're attempting. So it's important that, right from the get-go, you take a second to understand the dangerous aspects of collaboration and the potential personal and organizational stress that come along with it. Getting a grip on that now will greatly increase your chances of making collaboration work for your organization. In an article written for the Harvard Business Review, author Nilofer Merchant points out some of the more dangerous aspects of collaboration within an enterprise. At the top of her list is the impact of ambiguity on individual employees. She explains, "The fundamental premise of collaboration is that you can use it to solve complex problems that are beyond the function of one domain or expertise. That means that each participant needs to be comfortable with a certain amount of ambiguity. Most people have built their careers, perhaps even their identity, on being the expert. They don't like feeling ignorant." Merchant points out that collaboration has a tendency to create the same kind of ambiguity around roles, especially when a collaborative group crosses departments or business units within an organization. She says, "Roles and responsibilities in the collaboration space tend not to be hierarchical. They are often fluid, changing from phase to phase of the work. This can be especially hard for senior executives because it may mean taking off their mantle of being the chief of answers and becoming part of the tribe of doing things. It's clear that collaboration can push individuals out of their comfort zone and add an additional layer of ambiguity around roles within the collaboration space, both of which can conflict with individual behavior and therefore organizational culture. It's also clear that making the shift from a more segmented or siloed structure to a collaborative environment will initially cause pain around how the organization makes decisions and shares information." Merchant explains it in this way. "Collaboration means a shift from thinking big ideas alone and more into the real-time mess of problem-solving with others. Shifting work from I tell they do to a we think together approach will appear at first to be all about talking. But thinking together closes a gap. By thinking together, people can then act without checking back in because they were there when the decision got made. They've already had the debates about all the trade-offs that actually make something work. But that means organizations spend more time in the messy and time-consuming upfront process of designing solutions that'll work." Merchant points out that information tends to flow freely and often in the collaboration space, which can be daunting for some people. She explains, "Information is rarely left in any silo, but is shared and often combined in unexpected ways to reframe problems." Merchant notes that many people may experience an extreme case of information overload from the free flow of information. Others who have tended to withhold information as a means of remaining in a position of power may find the free flow of information threatening. The upshot of all this? Realize there is a massive behavioral shift that has to take place in order for collaboration to stick. You can't just buy a piece of software and train people how to use it. This is about people first. Focus on creating an environment of trust. Learn how to embrace conflict and encourage employees to share ideas in order to get the most out of any collaborative tool you put in place. You're probably thinking, is this all really worth it? The short answer is heck yes! There's no doubt that collaboration can help all kinds of organizations solve complex problems and boost innovation. A study conducted by Google and Future Foundation found an 81% correlation between collaboration and innovation. The more you collaborate, the more creative you become as an organization. However, that same study concluded that, outside of the technological considerations, management structures would have to change to accommodate the kind of collaboration required to provide a significant boost in innovation. We're talking about a wide range of changes that includes things like incentives, access to expertise from other departments or locations, and changes to the working environment. In addition, the study makes it abundantly clear that if there's no clear vision from senior management of how the organization will benefit from collaboration, the potential benefits of a more collaborative organization are quickly marginalized. The study supports the premise that effective collaboration is as much about trust, embracing conflict, and providing the right environment as it is about software and process. It also underscores the business case for investing the time and the effort needed to build the foundation for effective collaboration. Simply put, collaboration is the future of innovative enterprise. Why is collaboration so important for the future? Because there's a real global culture shift going on outside the office, and it's happening whether organizations are ready for it or not. As people continue to grow up using services like Facebook, Twitter, and Dropbox, they'll be expecting to take advantage of some of those technologies in the workplace. That same Google study points out that only 12% of the employees surveyed were satisfied with the technology available to them at work, preferring tools they use outside of work. So while creating a truly collaborative organization is a ton of work, external technological advances combined with the changing expectations of your future workforce seem to indicate that the organizations of the future will need to be a lot more collaborative than they are now to remain competitive. Aligning your organization, aligned and preparing for a collaborative environment means that, as you begin to implement tools that facilitate sharing across departments and locations, you'll have greater buy-in and a higher degree of utilization from your people because the foundation enabling them to confidently collaborate is already in place. That'll increase your ROI on technology investments. More importantly, you just might end up with happier people doing more productive work. Wouldn't that be something? If you're trying to better leverage the expertise of your people and the accumulated knowledge and creativity of your entire organization, you need to embrace collaboration. If you want to remain competitive in the future, you need to embrace collaboration. If you want to provide an attractive work environment for future employees raised on Facebook and Twitter, you need to embrace collaboration. Do you see a pattern? Now that you understand the potential dangers of collaboration and why it's worth embracing in spite of the foundational work that's required, let's get into how to get started. It's that time. Time to wade into the squishy stuff. We've been deliberately staying away from the technology part of the collaboration conversation for a simple reason. Focusing on technology creates a build-it-and-they-will-come mentality. Simply putting a tool in place and training someone how to use it doesn't motivate them to actually use it to accomplish anything. This is especially true if the learning curve is high or if the tools require them to change the way they work. The technology is simply the means to do their work. Before you can get them to embrace it, you have to change how they work. That's where our three essential ingredients of collaboration come in: trust, conflict, and environment. Don't underestimate the importance of trust. Author and consultant Larry Prusak had this to say about trust in a recent article for the Harvard Business Review. "If I had to pick the one thing to get right about any collaborative effort, I would choose trust. Yes, trust. More than incentives, technology, roles, missions, or structure, it is trust that makes collaboration really work. There can be collaboration without it, but it won't be very productive or sustainable in the long run." Trust in a collaborative environment is essential. As you pull people from different parts of the organization together to work on a particular problem, you're creating a new dynamic. As we noted before, experts may no longer be experts in this context. Senior leaders are not necessarily there to make a decision, but to participate in getting the work done. Roles may be switched around or completely ambiguous. There's only one thing that will hold a team together under those circumstances, and that's trust. Consider again conductor Charles Hazelwood. What happens in his scenario if the ensemble doesn't trust his direction? He explains, "When you're in a position of not trusting, what do? You overcompensate. And in my game, that means you overgesticulate. You end up like some kind of rabid windmill. And the bigger your gesture gets, the more ill-defined, blurry, and frankly useless it is to the orchestra. You become a figure of fun. There's no trust anymore, only ridicule. No one wants to be ridiculed. That's exactly why trust is so essential within an organization. If everyone's afraid that they're going to be ridiculed when they suggest something new, you can guarantee that innovation will be virtually non-existent. Without trust, collaboration will become less and less productive because no one's willing to take any kind of risk. Building trust within your organization is a serious commitment, requiring a lot of time and energy to cultivate, but it's an essential part of effective collaboration. In his article, Prusak outlines a few key strategies for cultivating trust. First, promote trustworthy people. According to Prusak, this is the strongest signal you can send employees about the fact that trust is important. Second, work with your own employees. In Prusak's view, this extends beyond your direct reports to people further down the organizational structure. Spend time working closely with them. Third, publicize the costs of distrust. Prusak believes that lack of trust, both internally and externally, increases transaction costs. Distrust, in his view, leads to all kinds of watching and recording performed by lawyers, accountants, and additional managers. All of this increases overhead. Fourth, give people a reason beyond their pay to come to work. In Prusak's words, embodying your strategic vision in a common narrative that everyone can believe in. And finally, fifth, reduce pay inequality. This is not simple or straightforward, but Prusak believes that this can have a huge impact on building trust. As he puts it, it's hard to establish trust between people supposedly working for a common good when one party is paid 400 times more than the other. Consider these steps and how they may apply to your organization. Some of them are straightforward and some are not. The key is to think about how you can communicate to your people that trust matters. Think about how you can build trust throughout the organization and create a firm foundation for productive collaboration. Now it's time to embrace conflict. Yep, that's right. The fact is, you can't improve collaboration until you've addressed the issue of conflict, says Jeff Weiss and Jonathan Hughes, partners in Vantage Partners, a Boston-based consulting firm focused on strategic relationship management. In their Harvard Business Review article, Weiss and Hughes go on to say, "This can come as a surprise to even the most experienced executives, who generally don't fully appreciate the inevitability of conflict in complex organizations. And even if they do recognize this, many mistakenly assume that efforts to increase collaboration will significantly reduce that conflict, when in fact some of these efforts, for example, restructuring initiatives, actually produce more of it. Conflict is the root cause of most collaboration failures. Consider the case of certain British megagroup named the Beatles. How about Simon and Garfunkel? You get the drift. The point is, most organizations, instead of getting into the root cause, deal with the symptoms of the conflict, and the symptoms lead to perfectly logical but totally ineffective methods for improving their collaborative efforts. Weiss and Hughes highlight a few classic missteps organizations make when trying to improve collaboration. Misstep number one, teaming. In this case, organizations think that collaboration can be improved by running employees through teamwork training. They cover subjects like clarifying roles and responsibilities, coming together around common goals, etc. But Weiss and Hughes point out that this approach, while perfectly good, is the solution to the wrong problem. They explain, first, the most critical breakdowns in collaboration typically occur not on actual teams, but in the rapid and unstructured interactions between different groups within the organization. For example, someone from R&D will spend weeks unsuccessfully trying to get help from manufacturing to run a few tests on a new prototype. Meanwhile, people in manufacturing begin to complain about arrogant engineers from R&D expecting them to drop everything to help with another one of R&D's pet projects. Clearly, the need for collaboration extends to areas other than a formal team. Teamwork training doesn't solve the problem because it doesn't address how to deal with conflicting business functions and divisional goals, which is a critical part of successfully working across organizational boundaries. Conflict is inevitable, and team members are often ill-equipped to deal with it. Misstep number two, incentives. Reward collaborative behavior, and you'll get more collaborative behavior. Seems logical, right? In practice, it doesn't usually work that way. Weiss and Hughes explain the discrepancy this way. An incentive is too blunt an instrument to enable optimal resolution of the hundreds of different trade-offs that need to be made in a complex organization. What's more, overemphasis on incentives can create a culture in which people say, "If the company wanted me to do that, they would build it into my comp plan." Ironically, focusing on incentives as a mean to encourage collaboration can end up undermining it. In short, it's often the case that the extra effort required to work with individuals in other parts of the organization, both in terms of time and potential frustration, outweigh the potential reward. So, not surprisingly, employees choose to focus on their own individual work instead of collaborating. And last is misstep number 3, structure. This is a classic misstep. The belief that if you create opportunities for people to get together, collaboration will just happen. Structure is a pretty broad term that includes all kinds of things like purchasing software, creating cross-functional teams, or developing processes that pull various people or departments together to perform key functions or to make critical decisions. Weiss and Hughes sum it up succinctly. Bringing people together is very different from getting them to collaborate. They provide an illustration in which a company develops an internal software system for submitting IT support requests. The point of the system is to eliminate conflict relating to prioritization between department managers and to enable IT to service the organization's needs while efficiently utilizing their resources. A perfectly logical and structural approach. Weiss and Hughes explain what happens next. Despite painstaking process design, results are disappointing. To avoid the inevitable conflicts between business units and IT over project prioritization, managers in business units quickly learn to bring their requests to those they know in the IT organization rather than entering the requests into the new system. Consequently, IT professionals assume that any project in the system is a lower priority, further discouraging use of the system. People's inability to deal effectively with conflict has undermined a new process specifically designed to foster organizational collaboration. The real takeaway here is that conflict is not something to be avoided. Conflict is as essential to effective collaboration as trust. They work hand in hand to foster conditions for real innovation. Weiss and Hughes explain the role of conflict this way. The disagreements sparked by differences in perspective, competencies, access to information, and strategic focus within a company actually generate much of the value that can come from collaboration across organizational boundaries. Clashes between parties are the crucibles in which creative solutions are developed and wise trade-offs among competing objectives are made. So instead of trying simply to reduce disagreements, senior executives need to embrace conflict and, just as important, institutionalize mechanisms for managing it. Give conflict a big hug. Nope, I'm not kidding. So what can you do to make your organization more adept at embracing and dealing with conflict? Weiss and Hughes provide some clear techniques that can help create culture that realizes that collaborative benefits of conflict. They divide their suggestions into two different categories: managing disagreements at the point of conflict and managing conflict upon escalation. The first category is how to manage disagreements at the point of conflict. Weiss and Hughes outline 3 components that, if implemented, can help create culture in which your employees aren't afraid to deal with conflict and, in fact, embrace it as an opportunity to make decisions that lead to improved results for your organization. First, have a common method for resolving conflict. There are lots of different methods for conflict resolution, but the key, according to Weiss and Hughes, is to have clear steps for employees to follow and to have the conflict resolution process integrated into other essential business processes of the organization. Don't allow it to be a separate function, because that increases the chances that it'll disappear into the background if it's not actively pushed by management. The goal is to have your conflict resolution process become a regular part of business activities, like creating a proposal for integrated services, working on R&D prototypes, etc. Second, provide criteria for making trade-offs. providing clear guidance for employees on how to approach the inevitable trade-offs result from dealing with competing priorities and can greatly improve collaboration within your organization. Weiss and Hughes point out that this isn't necessarily easy, but providing context for employees helps in key ways. First, it shows that management understands conflict is a part of running a complex organization. Second, it gives your employees objective focus to guide them into productive conversations about how to reach a solution together. And third, using escalating conflict as an opportunity for coaching. In most organizations, the natural tendency is to kick conflicts up the management chain for supervisors to address. The result? Managers who are removed from the conflict spend their time trying to resolve it. Not ideal by any means. Instead of falling prey to that cycle, Weiss and Hughes suggest investing that time into working with the employee experiencing the conflict directly. Resist the temptation and try to solve the problem, and instead, coach the employee on other courses of action or potential outcomes to investigate. It takes more time up front, but eventually employees begin to deal with the conflicts on their own without involving a manager. The second category is how to manage conflict upon escalation. Not every conflict can be resolved directly by the people involved. Sometimes conflict can become complex and they'll need to be resolved higher up the organizational chain. The key to managing conflict when it's escalated up the management chain, according to Weiss and Hughes, is to not only make sure it's resolved constructively, but to take the opportunity to model desired behaviors, too. First, have a requirement of joint escalation. This is a straightforward concept. Instead of each individual involved in a conflict going to the respective manager and escalating the situation, which creates a series of segmented viewpoints and solutions, Weiss and Hughes suggest a process for coordinated escalation. Present the disagreement jointly to the appropriate boss or bosses. Why is that a good idea? They say it helps eliminate the surprise and suspicion relating to a one-sided escalation, which is what usually causes damage to internal relationships. Second, managers should resolve escalated conflicts directly with their counterparts. This is another straightforward suggestion. Weiss and Hughes recommend a formal, codified policy in which managers agree to handle escalated disputes directly with each other. This avoids a few things. First, they don't make the issue worse by kicking it even further up the management chain. Second, it avoids the negative effects of a unilateral decision from somewhere higher up in the organization, which frequently breeds resentment and could potentially make future conflicts more severe. Third, make the process transparent. A common mistake is to hand down the decision once it's been made by a manager with no explanation other than, here it is. Now get this done. Weiss and Hughes suggest taking time to explain the trade-offs that were weighed as a part of the decision and explaining the process used to resolve the conflict will go a long way in garnering trust. In addition, it gives employees guidance on how to address conflicts as they face part of their daily work. The role of environment is important too. Now that we've covered the roles of both trust and conflict in setting the stage for effective collaboration, working on those two things will help you build a strong foundation for collaboration on an enterprise level, giving your people the confidence to present new ideas and a path for dealing with the potential conflicts that those new ideas create. The next step is to provide an environment that helps catalyze collaboration. We're going for the collaboration equivalent of spraying lighter fluid on a campfire. The goal is serious collaborative heat accompanied by an amazing display of brightness. In many ways, the role of environment is really as simple as the illustration implies. The best thing you can hope to accomplish is to provide regular opportunities for a diverse group of people to collide and share what they're up to. For proof of that concept, we look to a 2010 TED Talk by author Steven Johnson. Johnson specializes in studying the intersection of science, technology, and personal experience. In this TED Talk, Johnson talks about where good ideas come from and how environment is a critical contributor to the generation of really good ideas. To explain why environment is important, Johnson travels way back to the 1650s to study the role of the coffee house in helping to birth the Enlightenment. He explains, it was a space where people could get together from different backgrounds, different fields of expertise, and share. And an astonishing number of innovations from this period have a coffee house somewhere in their story. The coffee house became a catalyst for collisions. People would engage in conversation, share ideas, and refine their concepts. Johnson goes on to share some qualitative data that adds weight to this argument. He cites a study conducted by researcher Kevin Dunbar. Dunbar went around to a series of science labs and recorded every aspect of their work. Johnson describes what Dunbar discovered. Almost all of the important breakthrough ideas did not happen alone in the lab, in front of the microscope. They happened at the conference table at weekly lab meetings, when everybody got together and shared their kind of latest data and findings, oftentimes when people shared their mistakes they were having, the error, the noise in the signal they were discovering. And something about that environment, and I've started calling it the liquid network, where you have lots of different ideas that are together, different backgrounds, different interests, jostling with each other, bouncing off each other. That environment is, in fact, the environment that leads to innovation. Collaboration will require an environment that allows people to collide and share ideas, whether that be in person or virtually. The collisions are what lead to the eureka moments that can drive innovation. There's a reason Steve Jobs famously put the only set of bathrooms in the entire Pixar office in the building's atrium. Pixar's Brad Bird, the director of The Incredibles and Ratatouille, said, "The atrium initially might seem like a waste of space, but Steve realized that when people run into each other, when they make eye contact, things happen." In your office, consider whether the environment gives your people a chance to collide across departments. Do you have a virtual environment that allows employees in different locations to collide? Those collisions are an essential part of effective collaboration. As Johnson puts it, chance favors the connected mind. A final word before you hook up the NOS tank. True collaboration can be dangerous, but only if you don't understand the reasons why it either succeeds or fails. Collaboration is not a byproduct of software. It doesn't happen because you train people to work in a team. Collaboration doesn't happen because you switch to an open office environment. Real collaboration is the result of mutual trust, the ability to embrace conflict, and providing an environment that encourages employees to collide and share ideas. This is not necessarily easy, but taking the time to do the foundational work to create trust and embrace conflict will gradually create a culture that's built on collaboration, effective collaboration that extends beyond teams and across departments and locations. If you can get there, you'll have created the conditions that lead to innovation and a true competitive advantage that positions your organization for growth. The reason to strive for more collaboration, after all, is to better leverage your people and the collective knowledge of the entire organization to become more innovative and more productive. That's your real return on the investment made in building trust, embracing conflict, and creating an environment that allows ideas to collide. Ultimately, you realize the returns through new product or service offerings that get developed at a faster pace than would have been possible if they were developed by employees working in isolation. In many ways, collaboration is like hooking up a NOS tank to your organizational's engine. You have to be careful with it. It can be really dangerous if it's not installed properly. If you do it right, it'll boost your output and help you blow past your competition.
Thanks for listening to this podcast on collaboration. As always, keep on the lookout for our next podcast, Meditation at Work: How to Manage Information and Manage Your Mind. If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to listen to others, please visit our website at www.forimprint.com/bluepapers.